General George A. Custer, all his yeller hair had luster, but the general, he don't ride well anymore. For now the general's silent, he got barbered violent, and the general, he don't ride well anymore. Oh, the general, he don't ride well anymore.
WEFT, Champaign, Urbana, and environs, where the opinions you hear and musical choices are those of the speakers, your air shifters, or when Zara's running it, the selection of those hardworking folks behind the scenes who make all that automation happen. Well, I'm not hearing myself in these headphones. I'll try another pair of headphones. Looks like I'm coming through all right. I mentioned Steve Kinzer. He wrote Overthrow, about a series of regime changes that the U.S. has engineered around the world. He was quite eloquent just recently about the Kurds in Syria. Couldn't play that. It was from Radio Boston. I listen around a lot. And he shows up a lot of places here. He's interviewed by Flashpoints' roving reporter at this point. Maybe he's on his way to Spain like Amy Goodman is for the climate conference. I do have something on climate change. I've got a segment from Sonali Kalhatar's Rising Up. She talks to a representative of 350.org. I'll hopefully have some information about local activities. Hope they haven't all gone pie. But tune in and find out. We're suffering in this country from all that money spent on think tanks and public relations, and the media is sick, and the meteorologists and the weather folks who are pretending to be meteorologists on television don't tell us anything about the broader implications of the hellacious weather people are having around the world. And yeah, it's not just, you know, pestilence as or cast in the Bible. Human beings can have an effect on the rest of the planet. Carbon dioxide, though it is a very, very small percentage of the atmosphere, it's very pivotal because it has that dipole moment. Anyway, want to get a fair amount of that on. I have Francis Boyle via, who is an international law professor here at the U of I, has a good rapport with the aforementioned Dennis Bernstein. Got him to talk about a couple of things. I got the segment where he talks about Trump pardoning war criminals. He sees it as another article of impeachment, preferable to what he characterizes as the Russophobia hysteria. And I share a lot of his sentiments. There are a lot of things that Trump could be impeached for. I like the idea of putting in one of the articles the fact that he's flagrantly violating the Flores Agreement, which has been affirmed by courts, and he's still incarcerating minors by the hundreds. I think that would be a reasonable addition. One of the reasons I played Custer just because I like that song. It's so amazing that he did that in 1964. Quite the social dissident, I guess. Did a whole album of Native American songwriters. That wasn't from his pen, but he clearly made it his own in his derisive laughter there, wasn't it? The usual features. There's an event about Howard Zinn. That's the tie-in for me, is somebody called Howard Zinn's writing revisionist drivel. So got my ire up. And I'm glad there was a celebration of Zinn. And they chose Mumia Abu-Jamal to participate in it. Okay, let's hear his commentary from Prison Radio. You can find that easily enough. Find the briefs on Mumia's case. He's getting a retrial for the substance of the case. He got off death row, got his medical treatment, and here he is in good form.
Homage to Howard. Years before, we worked together. My co-author, Stephen Vittoria, and I. talked about Howard Zinn and his masterpiece, The People's History of the United States. We both were admirers of Howard, and we loved his work, and perhaps especially his ideas of what was called history from below, or how regular people, average everyday people, made important contributions to the nation's history by building movements for freedom, justice, and real human rights. Zinn, who grew up in New York's tenements, was such a man himself, and he embraced humanistic working class ideas. As a young teacher in the Jim Crow South, he saw everyday people, like his students at Spelman College, get beaten and arrested for daring to demand the right to vote. These events taught Howard about history happening right before his eyes, where he had a bird's eye view of the civil rights movement in Georgia and beyond. These experiences inspired him and supercharged his reading, research, and writing of true U.S. history. And Howard inspired us, Stephen and I, to write our own history, Murder Incorporated, which we invite you to read so it can inspire you. For Murder Incorporated and my co-author, Stephen Vittoria, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Let's give thanks for Indigenous resistance. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Thanksgiving is one of the great foundational myths of the United States, turning a single gathering of Indigenous people in Massachusetts with English settler colonists in 1621 into one of the greatest whitewashes of genocide in world history. Even by that time, Native people throughout the Western Hemisphere had already suffered horrific violence for over a century at the hands of Christopher Columbus and other European explorers intent on enslaving Native people and exploiting the region's vast resources. Thanksgiving has morphed into an event celebrating family, feasting, and football, a day off before the commercial onslaught of holiday shopping, although the Black Friday sales frenzy has intruded on Thanksgiving Day as well. On this Thanksgiving holiday, we should reflect on our true history and on the remarkable ongoing Indigenous resistance to colonization. Not long after that mythic first Thanksgiving, colonists flocked to New England, numbering over 1,000 in 1630 and more than 10,000 by 1640. Rapacious demand for land and resources led to the Pequot War in 1636, when hundreds of Native people were massacred by colonial militias, followed by King Philip's War in 1675, when an estimated 3,000 Native people were killed. One of the earliest proclamations defining the holiday of Thanksgiving, made by Massachusetts Bay Governor William Dummer in 1723, thanked God for allowing them, quote, to defeat in some measure the repeated attempts of the Indian enemy against us and to defend so many of our frontier plantations from their rage and fury, unquote. Similar racist language appeared just over 50 years later in the Declaration of Independence condemning, quote, the merciless Indian savages, unquote. The genocide proceeded from the forced displacement of Cherokee and other Native nations in what's remembered as the Trail of Tears to the relentless westward expansion under the racist Manifest Destiny doctrine, the imposition of the reservation system, followed by Indian boarding schools that separated Native children from their families, forbidding them from speaking their native languages and forcing assimilation, often under criminally abusive conditions. Treaties were made by successive presidents and always broken. As Oglala Lakota leader Red Cloud said, "They made us many promises, more than I can remember, but they kept only one. They promised to take our land, and they did," he said. In the fall of 1969, a group of Native American activists occupied the abandoned federal prison on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay. Their manifesto used sarcasm, demanding the federal government hand over Alcatraz because it possessed all the qualities of a Native American reservation. Quote, one, It is isolated from modern facilities and without adequate means of transportation. 2, it has no fresh running water. 3, it has inadequate sanitation facilities. 4, there are no oil or mineral rights. 5, there's no industry, and so unemployment is very great. 6, there are no health care facilities. 7, the soil is rocky and non-productive, and the land does not support game. 8, there are no educational facilities. 9, the population has always exceeded the land base. And 10, the population has always been held as prisoners and kept dependent upon others, unquote. The 19-month occupation involved thousands of people and inspired indigenous people across North America to demand justice. The American Indian Movement was founded, leading to the 1973 activist occupation of the town of Wounded Knee on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, galvanizing international solidarity for indigenous rights. On Thanksgiving Day 1970, members of the Wampanoag tribe organized the first National Day of Mourning in Plymouth, Massachusetts, with a march, vigil, and fast. The event now nears its 50th anniversary as a, quote, day of remembrance and spiritual connection, as well as a protest of the racism and oppression which Native Americans continue to experience, unquote. The youth of that era, now elders, joined thousands of indigenous young water protectors at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota in 2016 to oppose construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Among those young activists was historian Nick Estes of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe. Estes, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, recalled Thanksgiving 2016.
A prayer march that we led in the Bismarck Mall in Bismarck, North Dakota, to kind of bring attention to the Standing Rock struggle during a Black Friday shopping event, which was met by police armed with AR-15s, who then began punching and kicking water protectors who were holding a prayer in the Bismarck Mall. And I thought it was a really kind of jarring sort of contrast between the past and the present, to say that while there are sort of differences between the massacre of Pequots in Massachusetts to the contemporary sort of fight against an oil pipeline.
Now, almost 400 years since that first mythic Thanksgiving, indigenous people are at the forefront of the fight against catastrophic climate change. For that, we give thanks. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
It made me think of the book by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz called Indigenous Peoples of the Indigenous Peoples History of the United States. Obviously, a homage to Zinn there as well. I haven't read it. I've heard her interviewed, and you can find her on YouTube giving book chats and things like that. Most recent book is about the Second Amendment and the history of guns from a Native perspective to some extent. Okay, so much going on. Yeah, Amy Goodman's going over to Spain for the COP, whatever number it is. I won't make any puns on that. I thought of a few, but not the ones you might be thinking of. Maybe that'll be a contest. Locally, there's some activity. There's an ongoing regular potluck discussion, and typically at the IMC, I don't have that in front of me, but towards the end of the COP, there's a call for another climate strike, and Students for Environmental Concerns, been around a long time, that name, some continuity. They are hosting a event on the U of I Quad. That's December 6th, coming up pretty soon. So still recuperating from the holiday weekend. Hope you're doing okay. It's already 15 after the hour, and I've only got my two features on, so I'm going to go straight to some material. I mentioned the local professor of international law speaking at some length on Flashpoints. I've got some other stuff from Flashpoints with Stephen Kinzer. I'm going to try to excerpt on the fly. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was supposed to put on this first, though. We'll see how it goes. Probably put most of the MK Ultra Kinzer stuff on tomorrow. And I'm also looking for, I've just gotten the book. There are calls for it at the Urbana Free Library, so I have to finish it quick. There's another book I just finished. Don't read a lot of books. I'm more an online kind of guy. But Tom O'Neill and the guy who wrote the book on Prince, I can't remember his name, Pipin something. He had a, O'Neill as a journalist, had a ghostwriter. It's labeled under True Crime, but it's actually an incredible story. Doesn't resolve anything, as does a recent film about the Tate-LaBianca murders. But there are some amazing things, and it links up with the MKUltra story, because there's a fairly good chance that Manson and his crew were perhaps using Sandoz acid and getting some commercially available stuff, because the CIA had a place in San Francisco where they were dosing Johns, basically, to check reactions with an eye towards mind control. It sounds all very crazy, crazy making, but I dive deep into it, and there's something there. I don't quite know what it is, but I'll try to find a segment with him, Tom O'Neill. But right now, climate with Sonali Kalhatar. I did actually mention this at the top of the hour, so I better fulfill this with a representative from 350.org, a group mainly founded by a guy who came to campus at least a couple of times for a Friday forum speech and then major talk earlier. Some time ago. Actually, he collaborated with a local author on a discussion that I haven't tracked down yet. I'm drawing a blank on the name, but nope. This should be Rising Up.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United Nations this week released its latest emissions gap report. And by their own assessments, researchers called the findings bleak. About 4 years ago, country representatives from all over the world gathered in Paris, France, for the COP21 climate meeting at which the historic Paris Accord was signed. But as soon as he entered office, President Donald Trump pledged to pull the United States out of the modest agreement. And under his rule, greenhouse gas emissions by the U.S. have noticeably risen. China has also increased emissions instead of leveling or reducing them. According to the report, countries collectively failed to stop the growth in global greenhouse gas emissions, meaning that deeper and faster cuts are now required. The next UN climate conference, COP25, takes place December 2nd in Madrid, Spain. We turn now to Tanu Yakupitiage. She's the U.S. communications manager with 350.org. Welcome to the program, Tanu.
Thanks for having me.
So the last time you and I spoke, there were these massive global climate strikes taking place all over the world, including here in the U.S. Clearly, people around the world are terrified about what's happening on climate change. They want their governments to take action. And this report seems to show that, largely speaking, overall, the opposite has happened. How do you assess the findings of the emissions gap report?
Yeah, absolutely. And my first question to politicians, including Trump and other world leaders, is how many reports is this going to take for people to really recognize what is happening? Last year, the IPCC report said clearly that we have less than 11 years to really reduce warming to below 1.5 degrees Celsius. The emissions gap report that was released shows that with current country pledges, the world is heading for a 3.2 degrees Celsius temperature by 2100. And G20 nations account for about 78% of all emissions. And this is not the only report that's come out in the last week or so. There was also the World Meteorological Report that shows that the concentration of climate heating greenhouse gases has hit a record high with no sign of slowdown, let alone a decline, despite all commitments under the Paris Climate Agreement. And the production gap report that was released on November 20th shows that the world is on track to produce more fossil fuels by 2030, which would actually, you know, is one of the reasons why we would get to about 3.2 degrees Celsius. Like, this is an absolute crisis. And the reason why millions have took the streets is because if the people understand that this is a really stark reality. Already across the world, we are feeling climate impact. This is not something in the future. This is in the present. And world leaders need to wake up.
Some have pointed out that it's like being in a burning house and throwing fuel on the fire that is burning our house down.
Absolutely. It truly is. And again, I think that It is very clear what needs to happen. We need to phase out fossil fuels immediately. This has been the work of 350.org for 10 years, and this is what all communities are calling for. This is no longer a question of negotiations between countries. The fossil fuel industry has lied to the public for decades, and they should pay for the climate crisis that we are in. They should pay for lack of accountability, and they should pay for the fact that from the wildfires in California to devastating hurricanes that hit all parts of the Northeast, our communities are being impacted. All over the world, we're seeing these impacts.
The emissions gap report by the United Nations points out that the top two carbon emitters are, of course, China and the United States, which has been the case for a long time. Now, China, in absolute terms, emits the most carbon when it comes to per capita. It's the U.S. So those two countries, does the report point out that those two countries have specifically, just on their own, increased their emissions, which has driven global emissions increase?
I can't speak towards China, but in the case of the U.S., particularly given Trump's policies, there is an increase in emissions. Even his recent push to stop, automobile standards, this is all increasing emissions. And so, these reports aren't lying. These are peer-reviewed scientific studies that are really demonstrating who's at fault, which countries are should be held accountable, and where the there's a gap between commitments and what actually needs to happen. And the U.S. and China have a lot to be responsible for.
Are other countries meeting their climate commitments? I mean, I mentioned the U.S., I mean, the Paris Accord, which happened 4 years ago, was signed, very triumphantly. Climate activists were not happy because it was far too modest, did not go nearly far enough. But even that very modest agreement that had voluntary commitments from countries, if we set aside the U.S. and China, is there any progress, any reason for optimism?
Well, I think the issue is that the Paris Climate Agreement didn't go far enough in the first place, right? And the emissions gap report really shows that now we're at a situation where we need to go above and beyond the Paris Climate Agreement. Talking about the Paris Climate Agreement at this point is actually talking about way too much in the past. We need to be setting new standards for what it will take it's not even solving the climate crisis at this point. It's actually just slowing it down. It's going to require that we phase out fossil fuels immediately. It's going to require that nations go above and beyond the Paris Climate Accord. And so, I think even the question of whether they have succeeded in meeting the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement, certainly some countries have, but that's not enough.
Now, just specifically speaking to that, the report estimates that if we wanted to limit global warming to below 2 degrees Celsius by the year 2030, that means just in 10 years, we would need to reduce emissions by 25%. That's a quarter. And if we wanted to limit to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is really what's needed, we're talking about 55% lowering of emissions across the board in 10 years. And unless we're actually putting in place the infrastructure for that, we won't even meet that, right, Thanu? I mean, to achieve that drastic level of cuts, we need to be building the solar panels now, the wind turbines now, we need to be putting in place that infrastructure now, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, what this suggests is that all nations should be treating this like the emergency that it is. To get the Earth back on track to 1.5 degree goal, countries must multiply their commitment level or the level at which they pledge to reduce their emissions 5 times the current rate outlined by the Paris Agreement. That means that global greenhouse gas emissions must fall at least 7.6% every year to remove 32 gigatons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So it's massive. And the reality is we've gotten here because of the lack of political will by nation states all across the world. And what we do not want to happen is for politicians to put up their hands and say, well, there's nothing we can do anyway. The will of the people, 7.6 million people were on the streets in September. They are demanding change. And in all honesty, this is the kind of thing that causes a revolution. People across the world, young people across the world, they have a right to a future. They have a right to dignity. And at this rate, if world leaders do not meet to set new targets and to set extremely ambitious targets that they actually have to meet, we are going to be in an extremely bad place. And we already are in a bad place when you think about all of the climate impacts that are already happening.
And the COP25 meeting, which is the next UN climate conference, is taking place in Madrid, Spain, starting on December 2nd. It's going to go through December 13th. And I know you've attended several of these, Thanu. Does it seem to you that it's kind of pointless to continue doing these conferences when we just need drastic political change, changing the leadership of these countries so that we can start transitioning away from fossil fuels?
You know, I think that the fact that these reports have come out really, and it's come out a week before COP25, really is going to push world leaders at the COP to take it seriously. And I think that world leaders at this point should know there's not going to be an end to the kinds of mobilizations that we're going to see, where people are really rising up, people are putting their bodies on the line, people are sitting in politicians' office to demand change. This is going to impact election results. And so we hope that the leaders who are going to COP25 take this seriously. I agree that we are not interested in having just another meeting after another where there are no actual commitments made. People need to take these reports seriously. Seriously, this is factual evidence, and it requires a massive response. And one would hope an ideal out of the COP25 is actually a strategic emergency plan in order for us to really tackle the climate crisis and reduce emissions as soon as possible, starting in 2020.
The emissions gap singles out a number of nations, including ones where there are very overtly climate-denying leaders like the U.S., like Brazil under Jair Bolsonaro. The report pointed out that deforestation of the Amazon contributed dramatically to Brazil's footprint, and it has very specific conditions, including what China should be doing, such as banning all new coal-fired power plants, and even for India, transitioning from coal-fired power plants. But even developed nations like Japan and, of course, the United States, very clearly lays out how these countries reduce their emissions. But, of course, many of the leaders of these nations, such as Bolsonaro, such as Trump, such as Modi in India, would respond that economic growth is critical and that taking these actions would dampen economic growth. It's that same tired argument over and over again, right? I mean, this economic growth isn't benefiting the majority of people anyway.
Mm-hmm. The economic growth that people like Modi and Trump and Bolsonaro are talking about are very much in the short term. They are the plans of billionaires who only care about their money and the lobbyists who are going to keep them in power. This is not a long-term plan for economic growth. What is the point, in fact, of quote-unquote economic growth if by the end of the century, the majority of the world's population is wiped out? People really are not thinking about the severity of this. We are talking about the ways in which capitalism is not serving people all across the world, and what people like Trump and Modi and Bolsonaro are showing is that this is like the last gasp of capitalism. And frankly, it's a very dangerous one, because we're seeing the rise of the right from South Asia to the United States to Brazil to other parts of Latin America at the same time as we're dealing with this crisis. And so it really is going to take all of us to push for an intersectional approach to the climate crisis. Climate impacts every single issue of justice, from gender justice to racial justice to migrant justice. And we're going to see the severity of all of these issues really rise because of the inability of these leaders or supposed leaders to tackle the climate crisis.
Tanu, was there a silver lining in the report at all? Because we know that there are changes that are taking place on local levels, on municipal levels, cities in the U.S. and states, and the same is true in other parts of the world as well. And I believe the report did point out that there were a lot of, even if the actual places where progress on the climate is taking place may not do enough to push those numbers down, they offer a model, right, for larger scale projects?
I mean, I think the silver lining is that the world has woken up. Young people, this is one of the top priorities of young people around the globe. And I think that the push of civil society is going to be greater than before on climate. And it's really going to require that leaders step up in a way that they chose not to because they didn't think that the public cared. And so I think that our job as advocates and activists is to really hone in on this on public awareness and really push for, on the ground mobilizations for people to really be pushing elected officials at all levels. Certainly we've seen on city levels and state levels here in the US, leaders really step up and keep their cities or towns or states in line with the Paris Climate Agreement. But I hope that this really shows that even they need to go beyond. And so I think the silver lining here is the kinds of mobilization and revolution that will come out of the realities that these reports are putting out.
Another deflection mechanism that leaders use is to point fingers at the other, very much a habit in the United States to point to China and say, well, China is the one that needs to reduce its emissions. China very conveniently will point to the U.S. and say it's the U.S. that needs to reduce its emissions. But if you look at per capita emissions, the U.S. is by far the biggest emitter in the world. Do you hope that Americans specifically take away from this report that it's on us, you know, when the whole world is watching?
Yeah, absolutely. A comparison here is not useful. The U.S. is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases. Certainly, there are other countries as well, but like, it is the responsibility of the United States, it is the responsibility of the fossil fuel industry and the lobbyists that the U.S. leaders have uplifted over communities to take responsibility and accountability and to pay for this crisis. And Americans understand that their children are impacted, that there is no long-term projections for us as a society if we continue down this path. And I think that people are really waking up to the realities of
and
it.
The U.S. government's own reports on how climate change will impact infrastructure, will impact nuclear facilities, Superfund sites, show that there are agencies within this government that know they have to take these projections seriously, even if the person sitting in the White House doesn't, right? Which is just the height of irony.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely bizarre. And even it was actually around this time last year, right before Thanksgiving, that the U.S.'s own, the administration's own report about climate came out, and they tried to hide it. And so it's just completely bizarre that they would continue to actually offer, you know, tax reductions to fossil fuel companies over dealing with a reality. The thing about Donald Trump is that he knows that he's not going to be around 50 years from now. He's not going to be around 100 years from now. But what he does and what his administration does today and over this next year, and, you know, there is also a possibility over the next 4 years, really is going to have such irreversible damages. And the people most impacted are Black communities, brown communities, indigenous communities, low-income people, and there is no going back. We need to take this seriously, and we need to make these drastic changes now.
One of the other sort of silver linings in the UN report was that the cost of renewable energy sources and building infrastructure for renewable energy and the raw materials for it has actually gone down. I mean, on the one hand, of course, this is a great thing and can help transition our economies. On the other hand, people point out the demand for extraction of certain minerals that these technologies require often comes from poor countries, impacting poor economies. And so I want to just go back to what you were saying earlier, that it really does need to be a just transition, not just a transition, but a just transition, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like when we talk about climate justice, we're talking about worker rights, we're talking about migrant rights, we're talking about, you know, dignity and justice for all. And so, you know, it is a big deal that it is actually cheaper to put in place solar. And we want that. And we also want to make sure that what we're doing is transitioning people across the world to jobs in 100% renewables that pay well, that are able to sustain families. And it is possible. It just requires political will.
Right. And so that's why, of course, a lot of people have been demanding the Green New Deal. Politicians are now waking up to that. So finally, let me ask you this, Tanu. While you and I are talking, of course, the campaign for the 2020 presidential race is in, you know, has started earlier and earlier every year. This year, it's pretty early. And whoever occupies that spot in the White House is absolutely critical, as we have seen over the past few years, to the U.S. and where it stands on emissions. How do you assess the amount of time that debates have spent on the climate change issue, and also in general, the sort of campaign platforms of various, at least Democratic Party candidates, in focusing on climate change?
350.org is a C3, and so I have to answer this question carefully.
Sure.
But just to say that we are, you know, we have pushed all candidates to ensure that they have robust climate platforms. We are watching them closely. We have pushed for, you know, MSNBC and New York Times and all of the outlets that are hosting the debates to make sure that they are asking robust climate questions. There were a couple of debates where no climate questions were asked at all, which we found to be absolutely absurd. What we have seen, however, for example, in the last debates that happened in Atlanta, that the way in which candidates are speaking about climate is much more advanced than it used to be. All I can say is that it is like climate is going to is a top issue in this election cycle. Voters are care about it. People who cannot vote, young people are calling on their elders to vote for their futures. And so that's really what we're going to be focusing on in order to ensure that, people get to vote based on climate and that the candidates really are putting out the most ambitious climate plans possible.
Thanu, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out a website for 350, well, 350.org, I guess.
Yeah, it's 350.org and it's 350.org on all social media platforms.
Thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Thanu Yakupitiage. She's the U.S. Communications Manager for the organization 350.org. We've been discussing the latest UN emissions gap report. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
That's a Pacifica program out of KPFA. It's a morning show. Goes out quite early. I think KPFT Houston runs it at 6 a.m., so she must get up at 4 a.m. California time to get those shows going. Okay, I did find out the information about the potluck, community potluck on climate change, concerned individuals. I suppose, dissenting people could show up if they brought a warm-covered dish. But I'm going to reprise the climate strike schedule on the U of I campus. 11:30 to 2 at the Union. That would be on the south patio, I suppose, unless it's terribly inclement. Windier these days. March to the Swanland, just a couple blocks away. Rally at Swanland, 3:10 to 2:30. That's on Friday the 6th, I believe. And then the aforementioned Community Potluck for Climate Action at the UCIMC, Independent Media Center, part of the old post office complex, or I guess the post office part of the IMC complex now. Sponsored by a group, RiRi Cassandra Project. I'm not sure what the RiRi is about. But that is an event. They'll be sharing the participation with this November 29th event. An update on the actions planned by the climate strike at the campus. And the specifics of that are what? 6 to 8 on Thursday, December 5th, so the Thursday before the Friday campus event. Okay, change in plans. I guess we won't revisit the SEAL, Navy SEAL controversy that led to the forced resignation or whatever it was of the NAVE secretary, SecNav. I guess they call them in the lingo, and the whole brouhaha about it. I guess that's a diminutive. It shouldn't be. It's a total scandal. As I mentioned, Francis Boyle suggested it's impeachable. So what does Trump do that isn't impeachable, I guess, maybe, would be a better question. Sparing the life of the turkey, I suppose. Okay, 22 minutes left, so I guess we're going to pitch together some of the Steve Kinzer stuff instead of playing that. Maybe I'll get to a bit of that tomorrow. Flashpoints. Oh, yeah, I didn't say that when we were playing the Thanksgiving essay by Amy Goodman. The Alcatraz Island event was featured in that. KPFA Berkeley does a sunrise ceremony broadcast with and the Native American groups in the region and goes out to Alcatraz and records people. And it's usually done live, and then it's represented on Flashpoints, which is a late afternoon show, even our time. And that's what I'm going to go to now. And I'm going to patch together two segments of this Kinzer interview because it hooks up with the other book, the book called Chaos by Tom O'Neill, in a very peculiar way, it seems to me. We'll hear a segment from this in the middle where he talks about MK Ultra in San Francisco. It's too hard to explain some of the import of the O'Neill book. Suffice it to say is that there were intelligence communities involved. If you put yourself back in the context of the time, This is the time when COINTELPRO was putting the US organization against the Black Panthers, two black nationalist groups, if you will. That's not the right term, but it's the one that's used in the LA area. Manson was a total racist and was trying to make a race war, supposedly. That's one of the contested arguments. Might have been something else going on, might have been multi-determined. I recommend the book. It reads like a true crime novel or piece, and that's what it's categorized as, which is not my forte. I don't like it, but there's two particular chapters on the MK Ultra and then on the this idea that some movers and shakers might have been thinking of enlisting the Manson family into COINTELPRO and pit the hippies against the uppity blacks. That's the capsule. The book does a great job of exploring the issue, not coming to any concrete conclusions. And all right, well, here's a little vignette from Kinzer. Much more, well, he's got a lot of cred. He wasn't a Hollywood reporter like O'Neill was most of his career.
But tell us a little bit about that brothel in San Francisco and some of the players around there. There was sort of a wayward, if you will, FBI agent, or was he a CIA agent?
So Gottlieb was trying everything possible to find out tools of mind control. And some of the projects he went off on were completely bizarre. One of them was this one that he set up in San Francisco called Operation Midnight Climax. He hired a guy who was a federal narcotics agent, a guy named George Hunter White. And his job was to set up a bordello in a nice apartment on Telegraph Hill in San Francisco and to run a ring of prostitutes who would bring men to this apartment and then feed them drugs unwittingly. The idea being to see whether various combinations of drugs and sex would have some influence in loosening men's tongues or making them say things that they might not otherwise say. Meanwhile, George Hunter White is watching all of this through a one-way mirror, zero training in psychology or any other relevant field, and he's just sitting on his portable toilet drinking martinis out of a pitcher while watching all of this unfold. So your tax dollars at work was sponsoring a bordello in San Francisco, the purpose of which was to defend the United States against the communist threat.
Well, of course, I had to ask that question because it's my hometown, and I want folks to know some of the more sordid history of San Francisco. Well,
Dennis Bernstein, he's away from home in New York doing that interview. Kinzer is the author of Poisoner in Chief, about this Sidney Gottlieb guy. And I played some segments before from an earlier another Pacifica program, and one of the takeaways was that he was preoccupied with Gottlieb because Gottlieb was like a Cold War liberal or something, and he wanted to see what Kinzer would do, what Gottlieb would do, justifying it all. The extents that it would go, and some of that we'll hear in this next segment, I hope. This was from the 21st of November. Flashpoints, if you want to try and search it out.
And a lot more. Stay tuned. In New York City, this is Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we are delighted to have joining us here in New York, Mr. Stephen Kinzer. He is the author, most recently, of Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. Welcome, Mr. Kinzer. Good to meet you here in person.
Good to be with you.
Well, maybe we can begin. Paint us a bit of a portrait of Gottlieb's early life, his upbringing in the Bronx, something about his familial upbringing.
This book is essentially the biography of a person who didn't exist, a person who was totally invisible. So I've had to try to piece together his life. And I do think I discovered the most powerful unknown American of the 20th century, unless there was somebody else who conducted extreme experiments across three continents, lived in total invisibility, and had a license to kill,
you'd
effectively
be hard pressed to find
issued by the U.S. government. So Sidney Gottlieb was hired by the CIA in 1951. His job was laughably daunting. Find a pill or a potion or a technique that will allow us to control people's minds and therefore defeat communism and establish the triumph of the United States forever. So Gottlieb was an ideally suited character in one sense. He was a visionary chemist. He was not restricted by the moral or ethical restrictions that some of us might feel. But in other ways, he was a very unusual choice. First of all, he was very different in his background from the officers of the early CIA. They were all silver spoon types who knew each other from the same prep schools and investment banks and law firms. Gottlieb wasn't like this. He was an immigrant who came from a family in the Bronx. He went to City College. He stuttered. He had a limp. In many ways, he was quite an outsider. In addition to that, he had a private life that was completely different from that of anybody else in the early CIA, and probably different from almost every other government civil servant in Washington during the 1950s. He lived in an eco cabin in the woods with no running water. He meditated. He studied Buddhism. He wrote poetry. He grew his own vegetables. He got up before dawn to milk his goats to make his own yogurt. So he was a person who considered himself deeply spiritual, deeply compassionate, certainly the most gentle-hearted torturer America ever produced.
So he was sort of a progressive when it came to his home social life and his home life, and he was really ahead of his time.
You could call him a proto-hippie. He really was a person who wanted to live a totally individual life, meanwhile, in his day job, conducting these bizarre experiments that destroyed the lives of unknown numbers of people.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the social conditions that brought him into this position. He was somebody who was quite patriotic. When World War II came around, he wanted to go and fight for his country. He tried to enlist, but he was born, I guess, with a club foot, correct?
Yes.
Interestingly enough, later on, that would sort of give him a certain camaraderie with his handler, Alan Dulles, who was also born with a club foot. That's sort of strange, but tell us about that.
So Gottlieb was a figure in whom Dulles had full confidence. The fact that they were both born with club feet might have been an unspoken bond between them. But actually, I think that Alan Dulles, the director of the CIA, didn't really want to know what Gottlieb was doing. He knew that it was bloody, that it was awful, that people were probably being killed, and that's exactly why he didn't want to know about it. Ignorance is an asset in the culture of the CIA or any other secret service. You want to have deniability. What this meant in practice was that Sidney Gottlieb was essentially completely free of supervision. He was not a sadist, but he might as well have been, considering everything that he did. And the fact that he was able to do this without anyone looking over his shoulder is one of the most bizarre aspects of his career, because he was conducting the most extreme experiments on human subjects that have ever been conducted by an agent or an agency of the U.S. government. And he was able to requisition human subjects, including subjects who would die under his treatment, almost at will in Europe and in East Asia.
Tell us now a little bit about the evolution of MK Ultra and how he became the leader, really a key role. He played a key role in expanding that sort of potential use of mind control to control the lives of politicians, generals who opposed the United States, and any foreign administration that might threaten the United States.
Gottlieb was the chief CIA chemist. In this position, he was given the responsibility to direct MK Ultra. That was the CIA's search for techniques of mind control. Alan Dulles, the CIA director, considered this project so important that he named it MK Ultra, because it was the ultra goal. If this could be accomplished, if the CIA could find a way to control people's minds, then, as Alan Dulles saw it, the other successes of the CIA in the early Cold War, like overthrowing the government of Guatemala or overthrowing the government of Iran, would pale into insignificance. So Gottlieb's assignment was to find the key to mind control. He decided that this would be a two-part process. Before you could figure out a way to insert a new mind into somebody's brain, You first had to blast away the mind that was in there. And he spent years experimenting with different ways to destroy the human mind, the human soul, the human spirit, and in many cases, the human body. He used massive combinations of drugs, electroshock, sensory deprivation, extremes of temperature and noise, comatose states, all kinds of tools that you could imagine. He left behind him, as you can guess, a trail of dead and ruined bodies. He did this for 10 years. He had experiments both in the United States and abroad. The ones in the U.S. were conducted mainly in prisons. He had an experiment, for example, at a federal prison in Kentucky, in which 7 African-American inmates were segregated into small cells and given triple doses of LSD every day for 77 days. This was part of Gottlieb's effort to figure out, can you destroy a person's mind this way? And guess what? Yes, you can. His experiments abroad were even more intense.
He also brought Whitey Bulger, the famous American criminal, if you will, into this. And Whitey Bulger ultimately understood what was done to him, right?
We don't have very many testimonies from victims of Gottlieb because they didn't realize they were his victims. But one who has given us testimony was Whitey Bulger, who was a 26-year-old prisoner at the U.S. Penitentiary in Atlanta, when he was told that he could get some good time if he would participate in an experiment aimed at finding a cure for schizophrenia. So he volunteered. He tried to get off the experiment after a while. What happened was he was given LSD every day for more than a year. And it wasn't until about 30 years later that it became clear to him what this was, that this was actually a CIA program aimed at seeing if they could destroy his mind. And he was so angry that he told his fellow gangsters in Boston, I want to find that doctor that put me on that experiment, and I'm going to kill him. Now, he never managed to do that. But if he had known that there was a Sidney Gottlieb, he certainly would have wanted to kill Gottlieb. Nobody, however, knew that Gottlieb existed. So after 10 years of these grotesque experiments, Gottlieb finally reached what you could describe as two conclusions. Number one, yes, it is possible to destroy a human mind with the application of enough drugs and other techniques. Number two, it is not, however, possible to insert a new mind into the void that you've created. So the whole 10 years of MKUltra experiments did not produce the key to mind control that the CIA imagined existed.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Stephen Kinzer. He's most recently the author of Poisoner-in-Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. All right, I want to go back to that, to what was happening in Europe. It's very interesting to me to see the way in which the United States worked to do this stuff in foreign countries. And I guess they didn't call it rendition at the time, but it contextualizes. Everybody was surprised. Wow, there's Abu Ghraib and they've got the CIA in their prisons and we torture people. But this has been going on in one way or another by various incarnations of the CIA and its leaders, right? This program was early on that.
In the course of my research, went to visit what I think was the first CIA secret prison. It's in a villa in Germany that looks beautiful, like it could be a B&B. The guy that owns it took me down into the basement where he has his storage rooms, and he told me, in these cells, the CIA doctors and their partners, who were the former Nazi doctors who had worked in concentration camps just down the road, conducted experiments that were actually just continuations of the experiments that the Nazis had done in concentration camps. And he also said to me, the older people who live around here know what happened in this house. It's not a secret. And they've told me that the bodies of the so-called expendables, the victims who were experimented to death, were buried in forests around here in places that are now covered up with shopping malls and apartment blocks. Now, I said that the experiment failed, and it did fail to find the key to mind control, which Gottlieb ultimately concluded is a myth. But Gottlieb did become the first person in the CIA to codify systems by which an interrogator can break the mind and spirit and resistance of a prisoner by the use of drugs, sensory deprivation, and all the other techniques that we now call extreme interrogation. And if you check the documents that were used to shape the Phoenix program in Vietnam, if you look at the manuals that the CIA prepared for secret police officers in Latin America during the 1980s, and if you look at the techniques used at places like Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, you can see the direct connection. So Gottlieb laid the foundation for what we now call extreme interrogation methods that the CIA is using.
Now, what's also incredibly interesting about what's happening in Germany and other places abroad is who Sidney Gottlieb is working with, which includes some extraordinary human beings working with the Third Reich and working in Japan in terms of mass murder, who had carried out unbelievably vicious and inhumane, and really you could call it mass murder, against hundreds of test cases, people who were arrested. Could you talk about that?
The person who directed what was essentially a vivisection shop for the Imperial Japanese Army in Manchuria would certainly have been hanged after the war if the CIA had not interceded. In the same way, the director of the Nazi biowarfare program would certainly have been hanged. In fact, he was a defendant at the Nuremberg doctor's trial, but the CIA arranged for him to be found not guilty. So the CIA's idea was, instead of hanging these people, let's hire them.
Yes.
We're trying to find ways to destroy human beings. These guys are experts at that. In fact, they have knowledge that we don't have because they were able to kill people during their experiments. So it didn't bother them in the least to be working with these people. And the oddest thing to me as I was coming to grips with this fact has to do with Gottlieb himself. So Gottlieb was Jewish. His parents had emigrated from Central Europe to the United States in the early 20th century. If they had not done that, if they had stayed in Central Europe, they might well have been swept up by the Nazis, and Sidney Gottlieb might well have been the victim of one of these grotesque medical experiments in a Nazi concentration camp. But in the event, he didn't have any problem working shoulder to shoulder with those very same Nazi doctors.
And these Nazi doctors, these mass murderers, were sought after. There was a lot of attention paid to try and get these folks hired by the CIA. I mean, people fought tooth and nail despite the fact that they understood who they were, right?
You're right. There was a program called Operation Paperclip that brought Nazis to the United States. And first, it was only supposed to apply to spies and rocket scientists. But the CIA and the people involved in MKUltra got ambitious, and they decided that we should use the same program to bring some of these chemists and doctors to come to work for us. I was quite shaken when I came across one document about a couple of Nazi scientists who had been brought to the United States to lecture to the CIA mind control group, and the subject of their lecture was the nerve gas called sarin. In their lecture, they went through all the protocols of how effective sarin can be, at what doses, how long does it take to kill people, and I found this shattering line. One of the points that they made in their presentation was the age of the victim apparently does not require any change in the dosage of sarin that has to be administered to create death. So in order to find that out, they must have had to kill adults and they must have had to kill children too. This was information the CIA wanted to have. So they were eager to bring these people to the United States and make them part of the CIA mind control project.
And just to be clear, despite the fact that everybody trying to bring them in knew exactly who they were, what they did, their role with the Nazis in World War II, and so on and so forth.
They went through a process called bleaching. American authorities working for Operation Paperclip would change their biographies. If an interrogator who had interrogated these Nazis had written a convinced Nazi, they would write not a convinced Nazi. Then they would add things like, he has a great family life, his children are wonderful. And this bleaching process allowed us to fool ourselves quite consciously about who these people really were.
Again, you're listening to Flashpoints. We're speaking with Stephen Kinzer about his new book, Poisoner and Chief. Just back to a little bit more about, now, he was doing all this stuff, and everybody wanted him to do it, but nobody wanted to know what he was doing.
I think this is obedience to a kind of CIA culture, which is probably a culture that's in other secret services as well. Ignorance is a cherished asset. You don't want to know a lot of things. I think that Alan Dulles and Richard Helms, who was the other CIA officer, more directly supervising Sidney Gottlieb, understood that Gottlieb was doing terrible things, that he was shedding a lot of blood and his victims were dying. That's exactly why they didn't want him to tell what they were doing, what he was doing. So in a way, this opened up the possibility, as happened years later, for the CIA to dismiss this all, the entire MKUltra program, as the excesses of one crazy guy. It's a way of avoiding the institutional responsibility of the agency and the U.S. government to allow him to go off on his own and essentially tell him, do whatever you want. You have a right to requisition human subjects all over the world and kill them, but don't tell us about it. So in a way, this was a way of avoiding responsibility, but it's not avoiding it very well.
Yeah, I'm screaming off mic, so I could actually maybe compose myself a little bit after that. The Nazi doctors and Sidney Gottlieb. Stephen Kinzer, he's the author of The Poisoner in Chief. That's the story. He's previously written Overthrow. He wrote a book about the Dulles brothers, a great resource. I'm probably going to play most of that tomorrow. I'm looking for a segment from that other book I was talking about, Chaos. And MKUltra and possible connections to nefarious deeds in the late 60s, poisoning. It's an incredible thing. Got those both books out from the library. I have to read Kinzer's in a hurry because there are other people wanting to get it. Thanks for listening. Gina's in to do continuity and maybe a little housework around the place here. Look, oh, just a little bit. She put the broom up already. Well, hope it wasn't anything I left behind. Opinions you hear here are those of the speakers. Think of that one next time you see Clapper or Brennan on television, the antecedents of the CIA. They're actually both lied in various circumstances to the House and the Senate. I think Brennan to the Senate when they were investigating the, at least that time, the torture report for the Senate and lied about